Welcome, everyone. I'm Warren Giroux of Sightline Wealth Management. Today, I'm here with Alex Tapscott, Managing Director of the Digital Asset Group of Ninepoint Partners. He's also the co-founder of the Blockchain Research Group. Alex, before we get started into our discussion, can you give our listeners a little bit of a history or background of how you got involved in cryptocurrencies and sort of what you've been able to accomplish in the field?
Absolutely. And thanks, Warren, again, for inviting me to join the show. So I first learned about Bitcoin back in 2014. This is, you know, before the word blockchain or cryptocurrency entered the vernacular. At the time, there was really this one single thing. And to put it into context, it was pretty small. Bitcoin as a asset class or as an asset had a market capitalization of around $3 or $4 billion. So if it were a publicly traded company, it would barely crack the S&P 500. It would be considered, you know, a mid-cap at best, even in a country like Canada. But as I looked into Bitcoin, the more I studied it, the more I used it, the more convinced I became that there was a real innovation here, that this wasn't just some, you know, new asset that you could buy and sell and maybe make money on, but that it actually represented a big shift in financial services. And at the time I was working at Canaccord Genuity in institutional sales. So I was kind of deeply involved in markets and had a real eye out for new innovations that were coming along. And what Bitcoin basically pioneered was something very profound. It was designed to be cash for the internet, a way to move money peer-to-peer between parties without the need for a bank. See, before that, we had to rely on intermediaries like banks and technology companies to sit in the center and act as trusted intermediaries. And that was true not only in offline commerce, but in online commerce. And Bitcoin basically solved that problem for the digital world. And what was really remarkable about it was that it worked. And it worked so well that it set off a spark that's kind of caught on like wildfire and captured a lot of imaginations and obviously has built a lot of value. It certainly captured my imagination. So within a year of learning about it, I quit my job at Canaccord to do something I'd certainly never done, which was to co-author a book. And I got lucky though in my choice of co-author. I ended up doing this project with my dad, Don Tapscott, who's a pretty prolific and well-known author, consultant, business thinker. And the book that we ended up writing together called Blockchain Revolution came out at a time when a lot of people were trying to understand this stuff a lot better and ended up doing really well. It was the first book to really describe why blockchain and digital assets were a big deal, why they were, you know, an important innovation and how they could be deployed in business and in other aspects of you know, society. And I think that sort of set me on my merry way to a career where I've basically just been in crypto ever since. So now, so counting 6 or 7 years, I've been at it. And most recently, of course, with Ninepoint Partners, where I've joined to lead the digital asset group. And that's been a really amazing part of this journey as well.
You know, Alex, before we get into the specifics of the Ninepoint Bitcoin ETF, can we explain to listeners a little bit about blockchain and what it is and how it works?
Yeah, absolutely. So in my opinion, blockchain really represents a new generation of the internet. And I'll sort of explain what I mean by that. You see, when you use the internet today, or at least the internet we're familiar with, to move and send information, you're not actually sending an original unique thing, you're sending a version or a copy. So Warren, if I, you know, send you an email, I can send the same email to all of our colleagues. If I, you know, post something on Twitter, it's available for all to see. If I, you know, want to forward an attachment of a document like a PDF, you know, I can send it to as many people as I want. So the internet is kind of like this, this way to kind of recreate information, like a printing press for information. And generally speaking, that's a good thing. And it's a very powerful tool that sort of changed how we access information, how we consume content and so forth. But when it comes to things that have value, and in order for something to have value, it needs to be scarce. And in order to sort of send something that's scarce, being able to create copies of that thing is actually a terrible idea. So if I owe you money instead of, you know, an email, let's say I sent you $20, it's very important that when you receive it, that you know you've got the only version of that money. and that you can't send a copy, or I can't send a copy to someone else. And the same is true for lots of other assets, things that require scarcity. So I'm selling a share of a company. You know, it's important that the buyer knows that they have the only version of that share, that I can't put it through the printing press and make more copies. It's important when I vote in an election that my vote is cast and counted only once, that it can't be cast and counted again. It's important when I buy a piece of art that I know it's an original, that it isn't a, you know, a forgery or a copy. So this idea of creating scarcity in digital goods that proved very elusive during the first era of the internet. Blockchain solves this problem. This problem is called the double spend problem. How do you ensure that when you move something of value between parties, that you aren't able to create a copy, or that you can't do the same transaction twice? And it does it through the implementation of this thing called a blockchain. And I apologize for the slightly technical definition here, but it's important to understand. You see, in most transactions in business and in daily life, there's a financial intermediary that sits in the center. And that financial intermediary, probably a bank, has a ledger. And that ledger says who owes what to whom, who owns what, and so forth, right? And we rely on these intermediaries to act as trusted third parties in transactions. And that ledger is really the thing that they control that has the value. The ability to trust that they're keeping track of everything is why we empower them with so much importance. What a blockchain is a ledger, except instead of a ledger that sits inside of a single company or institution like a bank or a government, it's decentralized, meaning that there's a copy of that ledger on every single computer that's connected to the network. And anybody can see what's in that ledger. And everyone can trust that what's in that ledger is accurate. But no single actor can alter what's in that ledger without the whole network agreeing on any change. And that's a process that I won't get into, but basically, this is a way to create a decentralized network for moving and storing value, where there is a trusted and immutable ledger that is transparent and available for all to see. And what's fascinating about this concept is that it was applied to Bitcoin, but Bitcoin in many respects is kind of like email. It's the first, in the same way that, you know, email was to the internet. Email was the first killer app for the internet, and Bitcoin is sort of the first killer app for blockchain, but it's not the last killer app. What made Bitcoin work can also work for basically any other asset in the economy, anything else that requires scarcity, and therefore makes it a very powerful tool.
Well, let's talk briefly about the 9-point Bitcoin ETF, and how is that different, or what distinguishes it from the other cryptocurrency ETFs that are currently on the market?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I've mentioned, blockchain is this platform that's enabling all sorts of new kinds of assets and applications. And the most important one so far is Bitcoin. Bitcoin was designed to be cash for the internet, a way to move and store value peer-to-peer without the need for an intermediary. And it's worked really well. And that's why today it has a market capitalization close to $500 million US dollars, which is notable, by the way. You know, Bitcoin's value today is greater than the combined value of every single Silicon Valley funded tech startup that has launched since Bitcoin was invented, combined, right? So you take all of the Airbnbs and Ubers of the world and you add them all up, and that is still smaller than the value that's been created by this single asset. And I think that's worth understanding, that this is something that has kind of gone from zero to something very big in a short period of time. But for a lot of investors, getting access to Bitcoin can be somewhat unfamiliar. I wouldn't say challenging, but certainly there's a learning curve. You've got to open up an account with a cryptocurrency exchange. You've got to then send them money and then buy the Bitcoin. And then you've got to decide whether you want them to store it for you or if you want to store it yourself. And by that, it simply means storing the password that allows you to access the Bitcoin. And those are all questions that I think for a lot of investors kind of cause them to pause before taking a step into this space. A good analogy is investing in gold. It's not challenging to buy gold, but there are all sorts of challenges that go with it. You know, you're going to buy the gold, then you're going to custody it. You have to decide whether you want to get a vault, Scotiabank, or do you want to get, your own storage, and you're going to get a safe, and where are you going to put that gold, and how are you going to remember, the password to your safe, and so on and so forth, right? These are assets that are custodial, in other words. You can actually own these things yourself. You can own gold, you can own Bitcoin yourself. You don't need to rely on a financial institution, which is one of the benefits, but also one of the challenges. So this is feedback that we heard from clients, both retail, institutional, advisors, you name it. And the conclusion that we reached when I first joined Ninepoint was that we should create a way for investors to get exposure to Bitcoin in a safe, cost-effective, and efficient way, in a manner that they can hold it in their TFSAs and their RRSPs, where they don't have to worry about counterparty risk or custody risk, where they can trust a manager, Ninepoint, that has a ton of experience dealing in alternative assets, including gold and other unique custodial investments. And so that's why that was the premise that we launched with the Bitcoin ETF. The Bitcoin ETF actually began as a closed-end fund. It was called the Bitcoin Trust, launched on the TSX in the largest IPO of its kind. At that point, we raised 180 million US dollars, 230 million Canadian, and then a few months later converted it into an ETF. So our ETF is one of the lowest fee ETFs in this space. We have a 70 basis points or a capped MER of 1.45%, which is very competitive relative to our peers. We trade very narrowly to our NAV. In other words, you're buying our ETF, you know you're getting dollar for dollar exposure to Bitcoin. We work with the absolute best counterparties and custodians. Gemini Trust LLC, based in New York, is our custodian. They have an insurance policy underwritten through Lloyd's of London, and also have an impeccable track record of custodying assets. And then finally, our ETF is carbon neutral, which is something none of the other competitors have. And by that, I mean, we offset 100% of the carbon footprint of the ETF, of the Bitcoin that the ETF holds, by calculating that with our partner and then offsetting it in the voluntary carbon market. Why is that important? Well, in general, we think it's good to try and decarbonize our business, and we thought Bitcoin was a nice place to start. But also, Bitcoin is known as an energy-intensive industry because of the process of maintaining and validating transactions on the blockchain does use a lot of energy. So we figured, let's eliminate any concerns that our investors and clients might have around that by stepping into the market and making it carbon neutral. And it's important, one more thing to know, which is that we pay 100% of the cost to offset. It's not paid out of the investor's pocket. It comes directly actually out of our 70 basis point management fee. And, you know, it's a cost that's material to us, but it's something that we do because we think it's important. So if you're looking for a way to gain exposure to Bitcoin in a way that is easy and frictionless and familiar, frankly, to how you invest in anything else, the Bitcoin ETF is a great way to do it.
So going back here a moment, when you talked about the blockchain ledger, so on the blockchain ledger, it would show the custodian owning X number of Bitcoin. Is that correct?
Say that again.
So when you were talking about the blockchain ledger and it being transparent, so if we were somehow to get the access to that ledger for Bitcoin, the trust company or custodian, I should say, that of the Ninepoint Bitcoin ETF would register on there as an owner of X number of Bitcoins. Is that correct?
Yep, that's right. You'd be able to see the transactions. We can see how many Bitcoins per unit. Obviously, it's very small because the units are, you know, around $12, and the Bitcoin price, it's closer to $20,000. So that'll be a funny ratio. But from there, you know, how many Bitcoins we actually own in the fund, and the transactions that we enter into to buy and sell Bitcoin would happen on chain, meaning that there would be a ledger entry in the blockchain that you'd be able to go and see. That's right.
So I know a lot of people are worried about transparency and privacy issues regarding blockchain. Has that come up in any of your discussions about the privacy issues of the transparency of the blockchain itself?
No. So what's important to know about the transparency of the blockchain, it's a great question, by the way, because it's something that requires some clarification. Transactions on the blockchain are transparent. You can see the wallet addresses of the buyers and sellers in a transaction. but there are no names associated with those transactions. Okay. So it doesn't say on the blockchain, Ninepoint partners bought and sold Bitcoin. And it certainly would not say that, you know, individual unit holder bought or sold Bitcoin. That you would never see that on chain. You would see transactions that we would enter into with our trading counterparties, where we might have like a big creation event or, you know, buying $5 million of Bitcoin. That's what you would see. But even then, you wouldn't know it was Ninepoint. All you would see is the movement of funds between wallet addresses happening on chain. And so what's interesting about that is that Bitcoin is transparent, and it is, but it is not, parties are not named on chain. Now that's led some people to the conclusion that it's fully anonymous, right? And therefore it might be a tool that's good for, you know, keeping private and then evading detection. And that's only true to a degree. Because there's wallet addresses, you can actually see the buyers and sellers. You can see, you know, their balances and their past transaction history. There's actually quite a lot of information on chain. It's just not the names of the party. So it's really useful for, you know, as a way to fund, you know, private transactions between parties, but not necessarily great for doing bad things, because ultimately you can figure out kind of who sent the money if you've got enough technology tools and, you know, resources and so forth. But for the average transactions, fully private.
Yeah. One other question that comes up fairly often with retail investors anyway is the thinking that the central banks of various countries are going to create their own cryptocurrencies. And if they do, what impact do you see that having on Bitcoin in particular?
I think it'll have a negligible impact on Bitcoin. And if anything, it may be a positive. So people say, well, you know, now that Bitcoin is sort of proven or de-risked blockchain, central banks are going to embrace it and create their own currencies. And I think that's probably true. And in fact, it's already happened in a way. So central banks, a couple of them have issued their own and created their own currencies, China specifically. But in general, we haven't seen it deployed at scale. But what we have seen created are a thing called stable coins. So a stable coin is a digital asset that is pegged to the US dollar. And the value of all stable coins in circulation today is already $150 billion. So if people want to use US dollars on chain as a way to move and store value, they can already do that. And they can do it in pretty significant size. Stablecoins are the two largest stablecoins are two of the five biggest crypto assets in the world already. So this already exists. So if the government were to create its own, I don't think it would be a negative. Now there's a scenario where it is. And the scenario is basically the government creates it and then makes Bitcoin illegal or something like that and says you have to use this currency. Well, that's a different kind of situation. But I don't think that's likely to happen, at least not in places like Canada and the US, where central bankers and people in government have, you know, voiced generally positive, not always positive, but generally positive views on the sector and this technology. That's not necessarily true, though, Warren, in developing countries. Actually, just so fascinating, right before our conversation, I just recorded a podcast interview with an entrepreneur who has a payments company in Africa, and they use Bitcoin and stable coins as the payment rail to move money in and out of African countries on behalf of businesses. And these are like Fortune 500 companies, you know, Fortune 500 companies doing business in Nigeria. It's earning money in NAR, which is the local currency, wants to convert to US dollars, get it out and put it in its bank account in New York City, right? So standard kind of thing. And what this company does is act as a payment rail to help them do that by basically converting their currency into crypto and then sending it to a wallet address where they can then convert it back into the currency of choice. And that whole process takes seconds or minutes and costs, you know, 1 or 2% versus the alternative, which is taking days and costing much, much more. So what you see there is basically crypto being used as a complement to other currencies or being a way to help bridge the gap. But in places like Nigeria, they're not as keen on this as they might be in Africa because they're, you know, basically they're worried about a process called dollarization. In other words, the local currency being swapped out by people, as by people who would prefer to use the US dollar or some equivalent. In the case of a stablecoin, it's quite close and maybe even much better than using, you know, traditional fiat currency. So my opinion is that if anything, giving people the access to digital assets, which they can hold in custody themselves, will be a big boon to crypto use, unless it comes with a ban. But I think that's unlikely to happen in places like Canada and the US, but much more likely to happen in other parts of the world. By the way, I might add also that even if those bans come into effect, I'm still deeply skeptical that they'll be effective, because, you know, banning people from using crypto is kind of like banning people from using, you know, electricity or, you know, the internet. I mean, these are decentralized technology tools that are kind of hard to control, right? So we'll see about that.
Yeah. Just another question that comes up quite often when you have discussions with people on Bitcoin. And again, these are people, you know, like myself and so forth, and we don't really fully understand this digital world, of course. So if you can explain to us, Alex, how is it, is Bitcoin a store of wealth? Is it what's the intrinsic value of it? Or how do you determine intrinsic value if there is one? Is it the, you know, what the last guy's willing to pay for it? Is it the cost of mining it and so forth? So can you give us a better view on what it really is? Store of wealth, money, transactional currency?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would look at it in a couple of different ways. So there's an analogy I like to use to help sort of understand this. And it's about the parable of the blind men and the elephant. So there's a bunch of men standing around an elephant. They're all blindfolded or blind, depending on the rendition of the story. And they're all touching a different part of the elephant. You know, one person's touching the tail and says it feels like a rope, and another person's touching the ear and says it feels like a, you know, a big leaf of a palm tree. Another one's touching the leg and says it feels like the bark of a, you know, tree or something like that. And I think that's sort of how people look at Bitcoin. You know, is it an asset? Is it a commodity? Is it a currency? Is it something you can speculate on, or is it a store of value? Is it a technology tool? Is it a new technology kind of paradigm altogether, you know, a digital medium for value where one didn't exist before? And I honestly, like, it's all of those things and more. So how do you value it? Well, you know, there are lots of different ways to value an asset like this. One is to look at it's how it's used. So right now, Bitcoin usage has increased by 900% over the last year, and it's driven largely by countries like Nigeria, but also places like Ukraine and Venezuela, where it's used largely as a way to store money against a currency, local currency, which can devalue by 2 to 3% a month. That's something that's frankly very common in a lot of the parts of the developing world. In places like North America, it's also seen as a form of store of value, not as sort of a lifeline against currency devaluation, but more as an asset that can complement a well-diversified portfolio. And we've done a lot of analysis on this. You know, that Bitcoin as an asset in a portfolio can be a great diversifier. If you add, you know, just 2.5% to a well-diversified portfolio, you can improve your risk-adjusted returns by, you know, over 50%. And there are lots of things about Bitcoin that do make it similar to gold and other store value assets. It's a form of savings that is not, or form of money that is not connected to a government or, you know, some central authority like the European Central Bank. It takes time and energy to produce Bitcoin, just as it takes time and energy to produce new gold. There is a fixed or capped supply. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoins. Right now, there are about 18.5 million in circulation. Similarly, with gold, there is still lots of gold in the earth, but it becomes increasingly unprofitable to mine it unless the price goes up. So there's sort of a natural control on the inflation of gold, just as there is a hard and immutable control on the inflation of Bitcoin. But there are some ways in which Bitcoin, you know, improves upon gold, I think. There's some ways I think it falls short, to be sure. Like, it doesn't have a 10,000-year track record. It has a 10-year track record. But there are some ways I think that it does improve upon gold. It's easier to move. It's easier to store. It's easier to divide into small increments. You know, it's hard to pay for things with gold because it's hard to break it up into little bits. With Bitcoin, it's digital, so you can break it down to measures as small as a thousandth or a 10,000th of a penny. And that's something that people don't really understand. I think they see Bitcoin, the price is $21,000 or something, and they don't even realize they can buy a fraction of a Bitcoin. You know, you can buy one penny of Bitcoin if you want. And so that means if you can buy a penny of Bitcoin, you can send a penny of Bitcoin, which means it can be used for different kinds of transactions. And it's impossible to forge, which I think is not well understood. Bitcoin transactions all appear on chain, on this blockchain. So you can always check and verify. You know, if you have a wallet address, you can check that Bitcoin actually sits in that wallet, that it doesn't sit anywhere else, and that someone else can't send it, you know, to the same person twice. And I think that's an important thing that has helped to create trust in the system and give it the value that it has. And then a final thing is you can look at the amount of energy resources that are put to work to make a Bitcoin function. That's a thing called hash rate. Without getting into too much detail, the mining process of Bitcoin spins out millions of dollars every single day that's paid to miners to help support the network. So there's an economic incentive to maintaining the network that I think can be treated almost like a cash flow measure when looking at it on a multiple basis.
So let's talk a bit about the price, because you mentioned that, and also the action recently with the markets have been falling, interest rates have been going up, and Bitcoin has been falling with the market. So the correlation is sort of like when we have crisis mode in the markets, everything goes to one, right? And here we are in a situation like that where Bitcoin is being, I hate to use the word, but it's being hammered quite a bit recently.
Yeah, no,
sitting around 19,000. And some of the technical people that I listen to on occasion, you see them on CNBC and so forth, and they talk about Bitcoin holding, I think, the 18,000 mark. And if it breaks that, then it could possibly go to, I think, you know, their numbers are being thrown out of 13,000 and 10,000. So what's your view on the market action that we've seen recently regarding the price of Bitcoin, and what do you think the prospects are going forward?
Well, I think you nailed it, which is that we're in the midst of a period of kind of great uncertainty overall in financial markets. And what we've seen is a rush for liquidity. The DXY, the US dollar index has hit all-time highs. The dollar and the euro are parity. The blue chip indices for stocks are down, and bonds have had their worst start to the year since the 1850s. So we're in this period where all assets seem to be getting hit together, right? With the exception maybe of the commodity complex, but even with recession fears, that's starting to roll over extremely hard as well. So these are not fun times to be an investor. It's hard to see kind of where you can make money. And a lot of assets that, you know, and historically have performed a certain way are not necessarily performing that way. Bitcoin, through most of its history, has been uncorrelated, and sometimes even had a negative correlation to a lot of different asset classes. And that has been one of the big reasons why it's had such a powerful impact on portfolio returns during that period of time. But during times of extreme stress, you do see the correlations go to one and it go down with other assets. So this happened in March 2020 during the COVID crash, when everything, that was probably more severe than what we're experiencing now. Where everything just got absolutely dumped together. And right now you're starting to see Bitcoin kind of performing more like a risk asset. Frankly, it looks a lot like a FANG stock. It has a lot of the same attributes. It's sort of sensitive to interest rates. It's worth a few hundred billion dollars. It's highly tech focused. And the chart looks really similar. Like if you overlay a Bitcoin and a Facebook and a Netflix and a Shopify chart, they all kind of look the same. So to me, in a way, it's a bit disappointing that, you know, it hasn't acted differently, but it's not really surprising, especially when, you know, even corporate bonds and other, you know, seemingly safe investments have been hit so hard. It's unfortunate, but not surprising.
Yeah, it seems like it's, I was going to say, highly correlated with NASDAQ recently.
It is. Yeah, well, we've been covering that a lot, actually, in our newsletter. And you know, for anyone who's listening, strongly encourage you to contact your Sideline advisor, or to go on our website, digital.ninepoint.com, to sign up for that, because You know, we do our weekly commentary on the markets and on sort of big trends that are shaping it. And this whole correlation story we've been covering for quite some time. I'm not sure when it will diverge, but I'm confident that it will at some point. Like, I'm not suggesting that Bitcoin is just going to be a proxy for risk, for equity risk, and that's that. Because if that were the case, then you could just, you know, buy a 2x levered NASDAQ ETF or something like that. Not investment advice. I'm just saying, if that's how it's going to perform, then there are substitutes for it. I do think that it will continue to differentiate itself, because I do think that, you know, Bitcoin is in a secular bull market that began when it first launched. And that bull market is not over yet, because it's not yet reached its potential. And I think has a long way to go before it does.
One of the questions I was going to ask you regarding the actual 9-point fund was, I read in the prospectus that you're not hedging the currency. So I was just wondering how the currency has influenced the price of the 9-point ETF.
Well, it hasn't really influenced it that much. You know, when we say the currency, we're just talking about the US dollar in that sense. So, you know, if the US dollar was at 1.26 when we launched, it's at 1.3, or I should say the Canadian dollar is at 1.3 versus 1.26. So, you know, if you bought Canadian dollar units, you would have gotten, I guess, a modest lift in Canadian dollar terms, because the dollar has gotten weaker over that period of time, but it's not super material. I mean, in the end, Bitcoin is a global market priced in US dollars almost always. So like oil, like gold, you know, currency risk is something that I think is going to affect it just on the margin. Really what you're looking at is the directional risk of the underlying asset, which in this case is Bitcoin.
Yeah. Well, I think that pretty well covers most everything. Is there anything else you think our listeners should know about the 9-point Bitcoin ETF before we go that we haven't covered?
Well, we've covered a lot. What I would say is that digital assets, you know, are a new emerging alternative asset class that I think requires a little more education than most. And I think during times when markets are running really fast and hot and prices are going up, it can feel challenging to, you know, get educated and capture the upside, right? And what's really interesting about these down markets is that it's actually a great time to sharpen your pencil and to learn about these new assets. Because if you're looking at your, you know, investments and portfolio approach, being able to understand how an alternative investment like crypto could fit, I think is really important. The shorthand version of that is bull markets are for earning and bear markets are for learning. And we've got tons of great resources, educational resources for people to start that learning journey. And, you know, learning about the Bitcoin ETF, honestly, takes 5 seconds. But learning about the underlying asset, why you would want to ever have exposure to it, well, that's a much more, you know, long and thoughtful process. And we'd love to help people understand that a bit better.
Well, I think that pretty well wraps it up. And I want to thank you, Alex, for taking the time. And we look forward to speaking to you in the future. Thank you so much.
I so appreciate it. And yeah, take care.